Sluts and Scholars, a podcast for professionals who prioritize pleasure.
You are listening to a pleasure podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Hey, listeners, you know, as slutty scholars here, we like to cover a wide range of important topics on this show. Just a heads up that this episode features attorney Lisa Bloom. We will touch on topics related to consent, sexual assault and rape, and the civil court system. As always, please take care however you need to. And as a reminder, I am starting to do Q&A episodes and segments. If you want to ask a question that may be anonymously featured on the podcast, go to sluttyscholars.com and click on Ask a Question, or go to the link in the show notes. I can't guarantee I will answer them all, but I look forward to hearing from you. You're also welcome to give feedback there, though I'd prefer you leave a 5-star written review. Thanks so much, and here's the episode. Sluts and Scholars is a podcast produced by Sluts and Scholars Media, LLC. It is a shame-free educational podcast made for your entertainment and informational desires only. The podcast, any opinions we share, and any resources, including social media and emails from us, are not therapy, medical care, or professional advice, and do not create a patient-client relationship. None of the information, opinions, suggestions, resources, or exercises mentioned in this podcast should be used without clearance from your healthcare provider. All opinions, information, and ideas expressed by the guests are solely their own. If you need emergency mental health or medical help, please call 911 or 988 or go to your nearest emergency center. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome back to another week of Sluts and Scholars. I'm Nicoletta Heidegger, and I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and sexologist, and this is the podcast for professionals who prioritize pleasure. This week, I am welcoming Lisa Bloom, Esquire. She is an attorney specializing in LGBTQ rights, civil rights, sexual harassment, and assault cases. Daughter of famous civil rights attorney Gloria Allred, Lisa was raised to help everyday people in their fight for justice. Her firm, the Bloom Firm, continues to focus on fighting for victims of discrimination, harassment, and abuse with compassion, as she is a survivor herself. She is also an author and media personality and has represented many high-profile celebrity cases, such as representing many of the brave Trump, Cosby, and Epstein survivors. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you for that nice introduction, Nicoletta.
Absolutely. So happy to have you. Okay, so firstly, I want to talk a little bit about our justice system. And so I'm a therapist. Obviously, the work I do with clients is very trauma-informed. But when clients of mine are working within the justice system, it's not super trauma-informed.
No.
And so I'd love to hear kind of just from your experience and working with folks like this, how is the justice system kind of like missing the mark about how trauma actually works and when people report and things like that?
What a great question. So in a number of ways, we need to improve to be more respectful of trauma victims. One is to understand how people report, let's say, sexual assault or rape. It's not a straight line. It's not as if somebody grabbed your purse when you were sitting at the bus stop and you would probably call the police right away and tell a clear narrative of what happened. A rape victim generally will not report it at all. If and when she does report it, it's going to be much, much later after she's had some time to recover and to think about it. And she will first tell the story typically in bits and pieces and often in a contradictory way. If it's an acquaintance, intimate partner violence, which it typically is in my cases, she may be covering for the perpetrator. So it takes a while for the true story to come out. And yet, even now in 2024, my victims get cross-examined by the defense about their memory and why don't they remember every second in perfect detail? Why didn't they report it sooner? Why didn't they report it more clearly? Why do they have inconsistent stories? So that's the first area where I'm constantly educating people in my cases and bringing in expert witnesses and bringing in the studies and explaining that sexual assault victims in particular have a different way of reporting. It doesn't mean that they're lying. And I think the second biggest issue is just how darn long it takes for cases to get resolved. The system moves very slowly. Most people just do not have the fortitude to file a case, to fight it for years, get eventually to trial. Even if they win at trial, it could take years to collect. We won a big sexual harassment case in 2019. $12 million on behalf of a sexual assault victim. And we have been fighting for the last 5 years to collect on that judgment and still have not collected a penny. So it's way too long. I'd like to see these cases prioritized in the justice system when victims do win. I'd like to see the defendants ordered to pay up immediately in civil cases. Mm-hmm. I'd like the appeals to be expedited. If we really care about victims, we need to move the cases through a lot faster.
And I mean, I guess we could just say that this is a systemic issue maybe across the board, but like, why do you think it's maybe not changing even though we have these expert witnesses? And do you think there is a chance there will be a shift?
So on the issue of memory and reporting, I do think there is a shift. I've noticed that jurors are a little bit more aware. I think since the Me Too movement, which began in 2017, they're more aware and they're more forgiving of a domestic violence victim or a rape victim, the way that they report, and that it takes some time. Mm-hmm. I think they do understand that, but the defense is still going to hammer them. And we need a lot more awareness on the issue.
Yeah. I mean, I liked what you were saying at the beginning, and I know you've been someone I've talked to about this for my own survivorship stuff, but, you know, in terms of all the things you were listing around trauma stuff, just I'll list some past episodes for you listeners to, you know, re-educate yourself around trauma stuff, but so many things are impacted with trauma, right? Memory. When we are in a fight or flight state, our memory is impacted, the part of our brain responsible for that. And our brain sometimes doesn't remember things that are painful. And so even when we think about like witness testimonies or memory, like it's so imperfect. It's wild to me that it's still such a key part of so much of this. And then the second part you mentioned is the shame, obviously the aspect of people that have these sort of dueling voices within themselves of like, is this valid? Is this not valid? Should I take this seriously? Oh, but I love this person and still want them to love me, but they harmed me. Like there's so many things. And yes. I know for me as a survivor, like years it's taken for most of the things for me to even make sense of and process, let alone, put anything into legal action. It's so, you know, beyond what our system allows for.
You know, and I would add to that there's, you know, most people have heard of fight or flight. And for assault victims, there's two more Fs. It's fight mm-hmm. or flight, but it's also fawning and freezing.
Yep.
And fawning is very common after sexual assault. So, for example, some of my Bill Cosby.
Or during as well.
During, yes. Yeah. So afterwards, they may send very friendly texts or emails, just really trying to say to themselves that, you know, nothing bad happened. Everything is fine. You know, even after Bill Cosby right. drugged and raped women while they were unconscious, they would still send friendly emails to him afterwards. And of course, the defense tries to use that to show that nothing bad happened. And then freezing. You know, most people, I think, still think, well, if anybody laid a hand on me, you know, I'd punch them or I'd run away. But the reality is that freezing is a very, very common response to sexual right. assault, where literally somebody just shuts down and she just remains still unless it happened. And it's called the freeze response. And that also still gets used against her sometimes. Well, why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you leave? The door was right there. But I'm sure you can talk about this much more, that that's a very, very common response.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it is enduring as well, because our body's doing what it thinks it's supposed to do to keep us safe or keep us alive, which is usually an unconscious survival response. So sometimes in the moment, it looks like consent.
Yes.
How do you fight this in a court of law when people are saying, oh, well, you didn't say no, or you didn't do this. Like, how are you fighting this?
Well, we have a very good research file and I've been doing these cases since 1986, and mm-hmm. this comes up all the time. So we have a very solid research file that we use at the early stage of the case to enlighten, let's say, a mediator, if we're trying to get an early settlement, which we often are, because I do civil cases. I don't do criminal cases. So I do civil cases for money damages. And, we educate the mediator, we educate the other side. There's a wonderful expert witness whose name is Dr. Barbara Ziv, Z-I-V. We've used her. I've seen her testify in other cases, like in the Bill Cosby case. And mm-hmm. she's just so knowledgeable about this and testifies about it really well. And I think, you know, when you hear the experts testify or you read the study, it does kind of hit you of like, yeah, we do kind of know this. on some level, right? I mean, most of us, if we're not survivors ourselves, we know somebody who is. And that person has probably said, like, you know, I never reported it. I couldn't report it. I thought it was my fault. Oh, I sent him these texts afterwards. Why did I do that? You know, it is a pretty common experience at this point. So I think people do accept it. And
I think they accept it in their head, but they don't accept it in their heart and body.
Yeah, I think that's probably well said. And then we always have kind of an internal debate, you know, for jurors, do we want men or do we want women? You know, women can often be very hard on other women.
Because we're taught to.
Yes. And, you know, men kind of want to kind of ride in and save the day for women sometimes. On the other hand, women are maybe more understanding about sexual assault victims. And so, you know, it's a constant process. But I tell my clients, like, we get it. We do not blame you. We understand this is the most common response to sexual assault. And, you know, we're going to fight for you because this is the way that we respond. It is not your fault. You are not to blame. You did not do anything wrong.
Yeah. And I just want to name for folks out there, like, I know you represent a lot of women identifying folks, but Freeze and Fawn is a response for all people and genders, and anyone of any gender obviously can be victim. Do you work a lot with folks who don't identify as women in your practice, or are you mostly seeing women?
True. That's a really important point. No, we represent a lot of men and non-binary people too. And for example, in the fashion industry, a lot of male models who are victimized. And the fashion industry is just awful when it comes to how models are treated. And you know, one of my clients, who is a straight man model, said to me, you know, I always thought when I heard these stories, like, I would just punch the guy in the face. And then when it happened to me, I froze. And I'm so humiliated that that's how I responded. And, you know, I had to explain to him, just as you say, that this is a very common response. Don't blame yourself. I represented a lot of men, and they often are very hard on themselves that they didn't, you know, just punch the guy in the face in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the man I'm representing right now, who he was sexually assaulted on a plane by a fellow passenger. And he said he got so enraged that he, to stop himself from punching the guy in the face, he had to walk to the back of the plane, report it to a flight attendant who really didn't do anything to help him. So, I mean, everybody has a different response, and there's no right or wrong response to sexual assault. It's all understandable. It's all a product of our life experiences. And of course, the 100% of the blame goes to the perpetrator.
Yeah. I mean, I know you said you do civil, not criminal. And so when we're thinking about statute of limitations, since a lot of survivors don't come out till many years later, how do we kind of work with that between civil and criminal? And what are the options for folks who do take more time to come forward?
So the first thing I would say is, if you were a victim of sexual assault and you are thinking even maybe you might want to come forward and have a case, you should reach out to a lawyer immediately.
Yes. And remember, Lisa is not your lawyer. I am not your therapist. General education.
Yes. But you should reach out, because that's always going to be a privileged and a confidential conversation. And I hate to have to tell people, oh, your statute of limitations expired last week, we can't help you. And that does happen. The statutes of limitations, which are the time deadlines to file a case, are very complicated, and they vary from state to state, and they vary based on what happened. So sexual harassment in the workplace in California, you have 3 years. In New York, you have 3 years. Those are the two states primarily where I practice. Mm-hmm. Other states, it might be 1 year. It might be even 6 months. So it's going to depend. And if you're in a different state, you know, consult with a local practitioner in that area. Mm-hmm. Sexual assault can be 10 years. It can be longer if you were a minor when it happened, and it depends on the state. It also depends when it happened. So criminal statutes of limitations cannot be changed retroactively, meaning if it already expired, the legislature can't change it and say now that's something we can charge you with a crime for. On the civil side, lawsuits for money damages, which is what I do, they can be changed retroactively. And every now and then, legislatures open a window, like a one-year window, saying you can go back in time as long as possible. That window just recently closed for some claims in California, not other claims. That's very complicated. Why they don't just leave the window open for all eternity and let the fresh air in is beyond me. But I think we're moving in that direction.
So that's how you were able to kind of get around
things. If the perpetrator was out of the jurisdiction. I mean, like it goes on and on. So the short answer is it really depends, and consult an attorney right away if you're thinking about bringing an action.
So is that how you were able to kind of get around things with things like Cosby and other cases like that that happened, you know, decades, potentially decades ago?
So Cosby, that was a really interesting one. So I represented Janice Dickinson, who's a very famous supermodel, probably the most famous of his 68 accusers. And what happened was when the whole Cosby story broke, which I think was 2015 or 2016, I saw Janice on TV. I didn't know her at that point. And she was talking about her incidents, her alleged rape with Cosby, which happened in the 1980s. And I thought, oh, shoot, you know, the statute of limitations has expired. That's too bad because she seems like such a strong advocate. Then the next day, Cosby's attorneys came out and accused her of being a liar. And I thought, aha, now maybe we have a claim for defamation. And I went on CNN and I said that. I think she got a claim for defamation. That's a 1-year statute of limitations from the date somebody made the comment, which was yesterday. And Janice, if you want me to consider this, please reach out to me, because people have to reach out to lawyers. We generally can't reach out to clients. So she did. It was like a miracle. I was so happy. We reviewed her case. We got declarations, which are written statements under oath from a bunch of people she told back in the 1980s. I reached out to all of his attorneys and demanded a retraction. Of course, they did not retract. And we filed her defamation case. We litigated it for 4 years up and down the appellate courts. They fought really hard. And we won 2 really important appellate victories that enlarged the rights of rape victims in California, which I'm very proud of, and which we call Janice's Law, even though they're case law, not statutes. But Janice, you know, gets the credit, and my law firm gets the credit for that. And the bottom line is we got a very significant settlement for her, which I'm not allowed to say the amount, but I can say that it was epic. And I was very proud of her. And that was a great case. So sometimes there's a way around. That was a way around. For Jeffrey Epstein, I represented 11 of his victims. We have fought in 2 forums for them, and we have won in 2 forums. One of them was against his estate, and the other one was against the bank, J.P. Morgan, because we allege that people at the bank knew what he was doing and they were funding it. So they were co-conspirators. Mm-hmm. And we've won significant financial awards for all 11 of our clients in both forums. So, you know, I always say I don't like the idea of a wrong without a remedy. If somebody has been wronged, especially if they've been sexually assaulted, can we find a way to get them justice? And we will try very, very hard to find a way. I want to be creative. I encourage my team to be creative. And sometimes creativity pays off.
Yeah. And I like that you, I mean, I don't like that you brought it up, but like, I'm glad you brought up the stuff around defamation, because I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about that. But first, I want to ask about the money compensation piece in terms of survivors that you've worked with. How do you see it impacting them? Like, do they feel like justice has been served? Because, like, you know, I think for lots of folks, even in criminal cases, like even when justice is quote unquote served, there's still trauma to be worked through. And so how do you see sort of survivors that you've worked with in terms of their healing and response as a result of getting money? Like, what does it do for them?
So I am an unapologetic, enthusiastic advocate for getting money into the hands of victims, for taking money from the bad guys and giving it to victims. Most of my clients are women, and here's what they do with the money over and over again. They go back to school. They change careers. They get the therapy that they have long needed. They get the medical care that they have long needed. They get out of a bad relationship because now they have a nest egg and they don't have to depend on somebody anymore. They take care of their kids. This is what women do with money. And the best was my client, who was a young woman. We got her a very significant, you know, multi-million dollar settlement. And she said, I'm going to go to law school and be a women's rights lawyer like you, Lisa. Mm. And I said, oh, that's, you know, that's very sweet. And she did. And I thought she was just saying that, but she really did. And now she is also fighting this good fight. So, you know, sometimes people say like, oh, you just get money for people. Yeah, I do. And I'm really, I'm also just a huge advocate for women having money. It's a whole other topic, which I could go on forever about, but money is security, it's power, and women should have their own money. They should not be dependent on a man or their families for money. You make your own money, you can make your own choices, nobody can take advantage of you, you can get out of a bad relationship, you can move, you can change careers, you can go back to school, you can do the things that you do if you have money. And if you have been a victim, you are legally entitled to it. And also, I really like taking money from the bad guys because the bad guys really like their money. And so it really hurts them when they have to write a big check, and they should. Now, is this complete justice? Of course not. A lot of these guys should be in prison, like Bill Cosby. He was in there briefly and he got out. Jeffrey Epstein, he was in there briefly. He killed himself. Maybe. Maybe. I don't know what to believe there.
You know things. Conspiracy.
I hear things. There's a lot of coincidences. Two guards were supposedly both asleep at the same time. Anything is possible. But these guys belong in prison for the rest of their lives. And the criminal justice system is woefully inadequate. But I'm very happy to swoop in and take money and give it to victims.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And going back to the defamation piece, I hear how you were kind of able to use it for survivors, but I also, in conversations you and I have had and what I've learned here, that it can be something that is used against survivors.
Yes.
And so something you and I have talked about previously is just around, you know, when people come out and potentially want to share their story, to speak their truth, to, you know, get more public support or to warn people about folks. What are the risks coming forward and telling your story, and what can we do about that?
So,
because I think a lot of people saw the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp situation. So she was sued for defamation.
Yes. And he won. And he won a $10 million judgment against her. And she won $2 million against him. But overall, it was a big victory for him. This is a big problem. And I have a lot of victims who reach out to me who did get sued. And, you know, truth is a defense. So if somebody accuses you of defamation and what you said is true, it's a defense, but you're going to fight the case probably for years. Defamation cases are hugely expensive. So I gave the example of Janice Dickinson versus Bill Cosby. You know, we filed the case. They file an early motion, which is called an anti-slap motion, which is a very lengthy, detailed motion. It takes us hundreds of hours of attorney time to have to respond to that, which we did. And then we win. And then it goes up on appeal. And then it's a lot more attorney time to deal with the appeal. So forth. It goes on and on and on. It's very expensive. Most survivors cannot afford these kinds of attorney's fees, nor can they find an attorney to represent them on a contingency when they're a defendant and they're the one that's being sued. So I have to tell people the truth, right? I live in the real world. I'm very grounded in reality. The reality is, if you make a factual statement about somebody that could damage their reputation, you could get sued for defamation. You are always safe giving an opinion. If somebody says, Lisa Bloom is ugly and stupid and dresses funny, I can't sue them for that. That's their opinion. They get to have their opinion. But if they say, Lisa Bloom stole money from me, that's a factual statement. It's untrue. It would be damaging to my reputation as an attorney. I could sue them for that, right?
And so could a survivor say, it is my opinion that this person is abusive?
No, because you can't try to, it's still a statement of fact. It's my opinion if you don't know them. But if you say, it's my opinion that he abused me, especially, no, that's a statement.
Like it's trying to, like, how we manipulate the I feel statement. Right. I feel that I hate you.
Right. You could say, I hate this person. That's fine. That's not a statement of fact. But a statement of fact is accusing them of doing something. They're going to say, I did not do it. And it's damaging to my reputation. The other thing is it really damaging their reputation? I mean, there's so much noise out there on the internet, right? Yeah. One social media post, does it really have an impact on anyone? Generally, no. You know, we all like to think our social media is the center of the world, but most people are really not that tuned in to the things that we say.
Ugh, this makes me sick.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by Dipsy. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short, sexy audio stories designed by women. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering their extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/S&S. And you guessed it, I am still listening to Killian, the Irish pub owner on Dipsy. The accent. The stories are truly immersive and a lovely way to escape to a fantasy pleasure-focused realm. Just do yourself a favor and meet my friend Killian on there. Or if that's not your jam, they really do have something for everyone. In addition to audios, they also have soothing sleep stories and wellness sessions and also sexy written stories to read. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering that extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/S&S. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to D-I-P-S-E-A. dipsystories.com/S&S. dipsystories.com/S&S. Now back to the episode. I mean, it makes my skin crawl, and I'm curious, like, so some of the worlds that I walk in sex education and things like that, you know, people have come forward against sex educators and things within my community. And within my community, there's a little bit more of like a, what we call like a restorative justice process, which like every sex party you go to or event, you know, there's often like people who are sort of the safety folks who help take these you know, complaints and help restoration happen and repair happen. Yes. How does that fit into this defamation piece?
Well, if you point somebody out mm-hmm. and you say, this guy's a rapist, that is potentially defamatory.
Ugh.
Yeah. If you say, keep an eye on him, I mean, that's more of a gray area. Mm-hmm. You're kind of accusing him of something, but you're not exactly accusing him, you know. So if somebody sues for defamation, they're always yeah. going to look at the exact words that were spoken. That's what the court is going to analyze on whether the case should survive or get thrown out.
Which is like so much energy on the survivor to have to say something perfectly just to speak their experience. True.
And look at the Amber Heard thing. I mean, she basically said something like, I am a spokesperson for domestic violence or something like that. She didn't even say Johnny Depp abused me. She said, talking about herself, which I would have thought would have been safe. Now, that case was brought in Virginia, where I don't practice, so maybe they have different rules. But that what she said was so tame. And his attorneys argued, well, everybody knew she was talking about him. Okay, maybe. I mean, the rule used to be that you had to be pretty clear. You had to name the person or have it be very obvious who you're talking about. You have to have a specific factual accusation. So, yeah, I mean, here's the other part of this, though. I want to be clear that there is legal protection if you file a lawsuit or if you file a police report. So you can't file a false police report, but if you file a lawsuit or a police report, that's called litigation privilege, and you cannot be sued for defamation for that.
Got it. So that's kind of, yeah, I was going to say, like, so what can we do?
Right. And anything you say in the lawsuit, including like testifying in court, testifying in a deposition, that's protected by the litigation privilege, and you can't get sued for defamation for those statements.
Yeah. And I'm sure there are folks out there who say, okay, fine, come for me for defamation. I want to speak my truth anyway.
Right. And I counsel people on this all the time. I mean, this is your choice, your risk. Most of these guys don't sue. They might threaten to, they don't want to, they don't want to get enmeshed in this. Their attorneys might tell them about what's called the Streisand effect. Barbara Streisand years ago, she had some house, I think in Malibu, and some news cameras took pictures of it. And then she sued for invasion of privacy. And then now the pictures were everywhere, you know, whereas there was like one picture in one magazine that a few people saw when she filed a lawsuit, everybody. So it really enlarges it. So if they sue for defamation, it may be that the whole story blows up and more people hear about it.
Right. Yeah. Any other tips for folks who are like, how do I tell my story?
Well, go to the police. So, I mean, if you were sexually assaulted, I really encourage you to go to the police. I have taken many women to the police to report sexual assault. I can tell you, at least here in LA, they're very good and respectful, and they take a full report. A lot of times they don't do much after that, but you don't know whether you are the first person, the fifth person, the 10th person accusing this person, right? Mm. So it's really important to do that. You might be a witness in somebody else's case, even if your case is time barred. So I think it's really important to get those reports out there. You could also file a lawsuit, again, that you're protected for doing that. But just talking about it in your community is difficult. Now, you can also try to get an admission from them, you know, by text. I've had clients who will text the guy if they had a relationship and say, you know, I'm really upset that you did this to me. I'd like an apology. And sometimes they'll say, I'm really sorry. And okay, now you have some evidence. So that's helpful. You can't record a call in California. You can in some states. So you can try to get some evidence. You can, you know, you talk about restorative justice. I think that's really important. I love restorative justice. Maybe you'd like to talk about that a little bit more, but I think that's a great process.
Yeah. I mean, I think it still needs, you know, a lot of work and a lot of sort of figuring out what that actually looks like. But, you know, if you're interested in that process, there are folks you can hire to kind of consult with to help on that. I'll put some links. I'll put some links in the episode description. And, you know, thank you for sharing that. But it's just so, it's so icky feeling, definitely, when you talk about some of these limitations.
Yeah, it is. And I do restorative justice cases too. Sometimes in mediation, we do it privately. I had a woman who was raped by a very high profile guy. She was terrified to come forward. We had a private mediation where she got to look him right in the eye and read something that she had written. Mm-hmm. And he said something very careful. He said something like, I'm sorry for your pain, which I thought, meh.
Not but really taking responsibility. Yeah.
Actually meant a lot to her. Mm, okay. She said, I needed to hear that. That really made a difference in my life after 25 years, you know? So it's not for me to say what she needed to hear. That's what really, really mattered to her. And then also we got her a significant financial settlement too. Yeah. So it can be done. And I think it can be very helpful to help people kind of move on.
And just for folks out there listening, you know, if you are worried about going to the police or need advocacy, or maybe you have gone to the police and feel like you're needing support with that, I believe LAPD does have, I'm in LA, I don't know about your county or state or city, wherever you are, but here we have victims advocacy groups that I think are run by an organization called Peace Over Violence. And they do have, you know, support folks that can help you advocate for yourself when you're having trouble advocating.
Great point. Yes, absolutely.
So I'm curious, with all of this, what have been some of your most impactful cases, either in this or some of the other work you do in LGBTQ and civil rights and all sorts of things? Are there any that stand out that you feel like have really helped you grow and change?
Well, thank you for that. I would say my Jeffrey Epstein cases, because we, as I said, we represented 11 women and we really had to be creative. Jeffrey Epstein was such a prolific pedophile and a monster. And he had a whole organization with Ghislaine Maxwell and then a bunch of recruiters. So when that whole story broke a couple of years ago, a lot of women started reaching out to me. And some of their claims were old and they were adults, so they didn't get the extended statute of limitations. And we really had to think about what's the best way to get justice for them. And we were able to negotiate with the estate after he died for a victim compensation fund, which is different than the way that we usually do things. Not only did we get them to put a couple hundred million dollars in a victim compensation fund, not just for my clients, but for all the victims, but we got them to agree to certain terms, like they would not use the statute of limitations as a defense when they were deciding how much money each person would get. That was very big. We had these Zoom meetings, because now we were in the pandemic, and also it's just so much easier for my clients, where they would tell their stories, they would be asked questions, but they would not be cross-examined. It would be very respectful. And it was. I was very impressed with that process. We wanted any settlement to not include an NDA or confidentiality. And a lot of my clients said, oh, it's okay. You know, I don't want to speak out publicly anyway. And I said, well, That's fine. That's your choice. You don't want to now, but you know, maybe you're 28 years old or 32 years old. You have your whole life ahead of you. And I can tell you, women get stronger as we get older. I see this over and over again. We get braver. We get a little bit more badass as we get older, and you might want to. And so I want to preserve that right for you. So those were some of the really important terms that we negotiated in advance. And then we had this whole process where we got our clients to tell their stories in these really moving Zoom meetings, which I wish everybody could see, but they were confidential. We got really elaborate reports from the therapists, from friends, from families. We made a strong case for each one of them. We got from the estate, we got really impressive awards for 8 out of the 11. And I said, okay, we're going to keep fighting for these other 3. I want everyone to win. I'm not just going to walk away. And we kept fighting, and we ended up getting it for all 11 after many more months of fighting. And then, as I said, then we had a case against the bank, which we prevailed on. And now we're looking at the FBI also, because the FBI knew about Jeffrey Epstein for many years and they failed to prosecute him. Those are usually very difficult cases to go after law enforcement for not prosecuting, because they have to make these judgments every day. But there may be a way. So we may come back a third time for victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I'm proud of there is not just, I think, the compassionate way that my team and I deal with the clients and work with them, but being creative legally and coming up with ways to get justice for people, even if other lawyers say it can't be done. To me, saying it can't be done is just...
It's a challenge accepted
for you. Throwing down the gauntlet, oh yeah, well, watch us, you know? And yeah. The best part of what I do is getting beautiful notes from my clients at the end, which often make me cry, about how we changed their lives and how they never thought they could stand up for themselves. And now, you know, it's just their whole lives are changed. Some of them say we saved their lives. I mean, it's incredible. And one of the things I talk to my clients about is we can do hard things. I don't think people tell women enough, we can do hard things. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, you know, just go sit in the corner and be quiet and don't speak up because it'll be hard. And I don't believe that. For most of us, we get stronger and braver by doing hard things. And standing up for yourself against somebody who victimized you is a great way to do that, especially when you have attorneys who are going to fight for you, who'll be at your side. You don't have to do it alone. Hopefully you have emotional support people. You have a therapist, you have your mom, you have your best friend, which we always tell people to have as you go through the process. But I've had clients come out the other end and say, I can't believe I did that. I'm like, what are you going to do next? You know, and they really feel so empowered and so strong. And that's the best part about what I do.
Yeah. Building that resiliency.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I know for me as a therapist, like I personally have worked with both survivors and, you know, perpetrators of harm because of the kind of specialization that I'm in. I'm curious what you kind of think about folks who, because all the cases you're talking about are ones that are like feeling impactful for you. And I'm curious what you think about for when folks get called on to defend perpetrators or defense attorneys who are defending the quote unquote bad guys.
Well, of course, I work with those defense attorneys every day. They're always going to be able to get attorneys, and they do. Everybody has the right to an attorney. I don't blame the attorneys for what a perpetrator did, just as like I don't blame a doctor or a therapist for what the perpetrator did. I do blame attorneys if they engage in practices that I think are disrespectful, are unethical. That's, you know, you can't cross the line. And they sometimes do really like going after my client or their family members, or they go after me, planting negative stories in the press about me. It's just ruthless and vicious. I don't really care that much when it's about me because I'm used to it. Like, take your best shot. You know, I'm still standing. I'm not going anywhere. But for my clients who maybe are not as thick skinned, you know, if there are negative stories planted against them in the press, for example, it can be very painful. So defense attorneys, sure, you know, do your thing, but be ethical about it. And then therapists, look, if you can help somebody reform or change their behavior, these folks should be in therapy. They should have good therapists. I think that's in everybody's interest, right?
And I'm also someone who does believe in, you know, restorative stuff as well. And so I want us to be in a culture where we can make fuck ups and mistakes. And I think some people can change. Some people don't and don't want to and can't and aren't willing to. But I think the people who are willing to get the support and are willing to grow and make new things for themselves, like ideally we can have a growth mindset as a culture.
I think that makes a lot of sense, Nicoletta. So I salute you for the work that you're doing.
So last question, because this is the Sluts and Scholars podcast, but this is a less fun slut question that I usually ask. I'm curious how slut shaming still shows up in cases that you're describing, and what can be done about some of that, as maybe our culture is demonstrating, I mean, there's still a lot of sex negativity, but in some of these bigger cities, you know, we see a lot more movies and, you know, books and things that are sluttier in nature. So are people still doing the slut shaming thing? And like, how much does that actually work?
So I thought you were going to ask me, am I a slut or a scholar? And hopefully a little bit of both.
That's the ideal. We can all be both.
To answer your question, you know, I think I'm the first attorney to actually use the phrase slut shaming in a brief that was filed in court. And that was back in 2017 when I represented Black China against Rob Kardashian, when after she broke up with him, he posted naked pictures of her on various social media. And it was revenge porn. And we came in and immediately went to court to get a domestic violence restraining order, which, by the way, people can do. And I wanted to educate the court that revenge porn is a form of domestic abuse, just like physical abuse or sexual abuse or emotional abuse. Abuse online is a very big, popular form of abuse right now, and it's very damaging. Girls and boys have killed themselves over it, right? So, yeah. It's very, very important. And even though Black China has posed provocatively and in sexy photos, and that's her choice, it's her body, that doesn't mean that somebody else gets to post naked pictures of her without her consent. So we actually used the term slut shaming in the brief, and I dropped a footnote and I explained what the term was, and I explained why revenge porn is a form of domestic violence and the court should recognize it and should issue a domestic violence restraining order immediately. And tell him to take down and not post again and not share these pictures. And we won, and the court did all of those things, and it was very important. So I was very pleased to have been able to sort of educate the court about slut shaming. I think it's still very, very real. I love that you use the word in your podcast title. I've been to various slut walks where people try to sort of reclaim the word, like we reclaim the word queer, right? I think that's great to reclaim words and take the sting out of them. But you know, you see a lot of revenge porn still, and that is a form of slut shaming. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it still out there. I want people to know, by the way, if you are a victim of revenge porn, at least in California, it's a crime, which means you can report it to the police. It's a civil wrong, which means you can go to a civil attorney and file a lawsuit. And it's also a form of domestic abuse, which means you can go in immediately without an attorney and get a domestic violence restraining order like I just described. And hopefully that can maybe help some people.
Yeah. And if you're interested to hear more about that kind of stuff, go back and check out my episode with Norma Buster from Kerry Goldberg's law firm. And you can hear a little bit more.
Great.
So if people want to hire you, follow the work that you're doing, how can they find your firm and get in touch?
We are very happy to talk to anyone who is a victim of discrimination, harassment, and abuse, and we do a free case review. So you can reach out to us at the website, which is thebloomfirm.com. Bloom is B-L-O-O-M. I'm the Bloom of the Bloom Firm, but I also have a team of attorneys and paralegals and assistants, and everybody is very well trained in these issues at thebloomfirm.com. I'm also on Instagram at LisaBloomEsque. I'm on TikTok, Lisa Bloom-esque, and you can reach out to me there. But the website is really the best way because we have a whole system and people will respond very quickly if you reach out via the website.
And any resources for folks who may need financial assistance with these types of topics?
Well, we only get paid by the bad guys. So you don't need financial assistance if you're working with my law firm. We work on a contingency, which means we only get paid if we win, again, by the bad guys. So otherwise, financial assistance, I don't know. And most people, I think, probably don't want to pay an attorney hourly to do this kind of work. If the other side does not have resources, and so it doesn't make sense to file a civil case, again, you can go to the police. And of course, you don't need to have any money to file a police report if somebody's committed a crime against you. And you can also report it internally, by the way. If it happened at work, of course, report it to HR in writing. Keep a copy in your personal file. Just be very factual about what happened. If they work at some organization and you can report there, again, in writing, keep a copy, because later on, they're going to say you didn't say what you said. So put it in writing.
Would that be defamation, like the HR stuff, or is it different?
Employment context. Yes.
Got it.
But if you're accusing, you know, it depends also on what you're saying. It's sexual harassment, which is verbal, you have less. Yeah. If you're accusing somebody of rape, yes, that's always
AKA possible. Every case is different. Consult with a lawyer to see what's best for your case.
But yes, that is true. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for helping break this down and for the work that you do and for joining us. Again, listeners, if you want to follow what I'm doing, I'm on Instagram at Sluts and Scholars. You can look at my website, slutsandscholars.com, and listen there or anywhere you get your podcasts. Please don't forget to rate and review and subscribe in case they take us off of the social medias for being too slutty. Oh. Lisa, thank you so much.
5 stars from me. Thanks, Nicoletta. You're terrific. It really is an honor to be here and be able to talk to you.
Sluts and Scholars, a podcast for professionals who prioritize pleasure. Sluts and Scholars is a podcast produced by Sluts and Scholars Media, LLC. It is a shame-free educational podcast made for your entertainment and informational desires only. The podcast, any opinions we share, and any resources, including social media and emails from us, are not therapy, medical care, or professional advice, and do not create a patient-client relationship. None of the information, opinions, suggestions, resources, or exercises mentioned in this podcast should be used without clearance from your healthcare provider. All opinions, information, and ideas expressed by the guests are solely their own. If you need emergency mental health or medical help, please call 911 or 988 or go to your nearest emergency center. We hope you enjoy the show.